5052. The old Gorbeau building. Then he looked at Marius. You saw only this bearded fellow, and the long-haired one, and Panchaud. You didn't see a sort of godforsaken, rodent-like little muscadine of a fop getting about over that way by any chance, did you?
No.
Or a great big lump that looks like the elephant at the Jardin des Plantes?
No.
Or a sewer rat that looks like an old red tail of an ex-convict?
No.
As for the fourth, no one sees him, not even his adjutants, clerks, and employees, so it's not surprising you didn't see him.
No, what is all this? Asked Marius. Who are all these people?
The inspector answered, anyway, it's not the time they come out. He lapsed into silence, then went on. Number 5052. I know the building. Impossible for us to hide inside without the artists cottoning on. Then all they'd have to do is cancel the show. They're so modest. An audience embarrasses them. Can't have that. Can't have that. I'd like to hear them sing and make them dance. This monologue over, he turned toward Marius and asked him, pinning him with a stare, Would you be frightened?
What of? Said Marius.
Of these men?
No more than of you,
Marius replied rudely, now that he'd begun to notice that this police spy had still not had the courtesy to refer to him as monsieur. The inspector stared even harder at Marius, and then went on with a sort of sententious solemnity. Spoken like a brave man and an honest man. Courage does not fear crime, and honesty does not fear authority. Marius broke in, That's all very well, but what are you going to do? The inspector merely answered, The tenants of that house have latchkeys to get in with at night. Have you got one?
Yes,
said Marius. Have you got it on you?
Yes.
Give it to me, said the inspector. Marius took the key from his waistcoat and handed it to the inspector, adding,
If you take my advice, you'll come in force.
The inspector threw Marius the look Voltaire would have given a provincial academic who had suggested a rhyme to him. With a single movement, he plunged both hands, which were enormous, into the two vast pockets of his coachman's coat, and pulled out two little steel pistols, the sort of pistols known as coups de poing, punches. He presented them to Marius with these sharp and short instructions. Take these. Go back home. Hide yourself in your room. Let them think you've gone out. They're loaded. Each one has two bullets. Keep watch. There's a hole in the wall, you tell me. The men will come. Let them carry on for a while. When you think things are getting nice and hot and it's time to stop them, you fire a pistol shot. Not too early. The rest's my business. One shot in the air at the ceiling, it doesn't matter where. Above all, not too early. Wait till there's some action. You're a lawyer, you know what that means. Marius took the pistols and put them in the side pocket of his coat. They stick out like that, you can see the bulge, said the inspector. Better put them in your trouser pockets. Marius hid the pistols in his other pockets. Now, the inspector went on, there is not a minute to lose on anyone's part. What time is it? 2:30. It's for 7 o'clock?
6 o'clock, said Marius.
I have time, the inspector went on, but only just. Don't forget any of what I've told you. Bam, one pistol shot.
Don't worry, answered Marius. And as Marius was putting his hand on the door handle to go out, the inspector called,
By the way, if you need me between now and then, come round here or send someone. Ask for Inspector Javert. Jondrette does his shopping. A few moments later, at around 3 o'clock, Courfeyrac happened to be walking down the Rue Mouffetard in Bossuet's company. The snow was falling twice as heavily and filled the air. Bossuet was just saying to Courfeyrac, Seeing all these snowflakes falling, you'd think there was a plague of white butterflies in the sky. All at once Bossuet spotted Marius coming up the street toward the barrière and looking a little strange. Look! Bossuet exclaimed. Marius!
I saw him, said Courfeyrac. Let's not speak to him.
Why not?
He's busy.
Doing what?
Can't you see how he looks? How does he look?
He looks like he's following someone.
That's true, said Bossuet.
Look at his eyes, will you?
Courfeyrac went on. But who the hell is he following?
Some cutie pie floral bonnet hussy. He's in love.
But, Bossuet observed, it's just that I can't see any cutie or any hussy or any floral bonnet in the street. There isn't a single woman.
Courfeyrac looked around and cried, He's following a man.
A man with a cap on his head and a grey beard that could just be made out even though he had his back to them, was indeed walking 20 feet ahead of Marius. This man was dressed in a brand new overcoat that was far too big for him, and a dreadful pair of pants and tatters, black with mud. Bossuet burst out laughing. Who on earth can that man be?
That, Courfeyrac said, is a poet. Poets love getting around in the trousers of rabbit-skinned peddlers and the overcoats of the peers of France.
Let's see where Marius is going, said Bossuet. Let's see where the man's going. Let's follow them, eh?
Bossuet, cried Courfeyrac. L'aigle du mot. You are an extravagant eagle. Fancy following a man who's following a man.
They turned back. Marius had in fact spotted Jondrette in the Rue Mouffetard and was keeping an eye on him. Jondrette forged straight ahead without suspecting that he was already being watched. He turned off the Rue Mouffetard, and Marius saw him go into one of the most grisly dives in the Rue Gracieuse, where he stayed for a quarter of an hour before heading back to the Rue Mouffetard. He stopped at an ironmonger's that in those days was at the corner of the Rue Pierre-Lombard, and a few moments later Marius saw him come out of the shop holding a huge cold chisel with a beechwood handle, which he slipped under his overcoat. When he reached the Rue du Petit Gentilly, he turned left and headed swiftly for the Rue du Petit Banquier. Night was falling. The snow, which had stopped for a moment, was starting to fall thick and fast again. Marius stopped and hid at the corner of the Rue du Petit Banquier, which was deserted as always and didn't follow Jondrette farther. This was lucky for him because just as Jondrette reached the low wall where Marius had overheard the bearded man and the long-haired man talking, he turned round to make sure no one was following him or could see him, then hopped over the wall and vanished. The wasteland the wall bordered was connected to the backyard of a carriage hire business run by a man of ill repute, who had gone bust, but who still had a few old Berlango sitting around in sheds. Marius thought it was wise to take advantage of Jondrette's absence to go back home. Besides, time was ticking away. Every evening, Ma Bougon was in the habit of locking the front door on her way out as she left to go and wash dishes in town, so the front door was always locked shut at dusk. Marius had given his only key to the police inspector, so it was vital that he hurry. Evening had come, night had almost closed in. There was now only one small spot lit by the dying sun in all the endless sky, and that was the moon. It was rising, red, behind the low dome of La Salpêtrière. Marius bounded back to number 5052. The door was still open when he got there. He tiptoed upstairs and slid along the wall of the hallway to his room. This hall, as you will recall, had garrets running off it on either side that were currently all empty and to let. Ma Bougon usually left their doors open. As he passed one of these doors, Marius thought he saw in one of the unoccupied cells the motionless heads of four men, which a faint glimmer of dying light falling through a dormer window lit up. Marius did not try to see, not wanting to be seen. He managed to make it back to his room without being spotted and without any noise, just in the nick of time. A second later, he heard Ma Bougon going out and locking the front door of the house behind her. Where you will find the words of an English tune fashionable in 1832. Now you sat on his bed. It might have been 5:30. A mere half an hour separated him from what was to come. He could hear his arteries thumping the way you can hear the ticking of a clock in the dark. He thought of the double march that was going on at that moment in the shadows, crime advancing on one side, justice coming from the other. He wasn't frightened, but he could not think without a certain shudder of the things that were going to happen, like all who suddenly embark on an amazing adventure out of the blue. This whole day had the effect on him of a dream. And in order not to feel he was in the throes of a nightmare, he needed to feel the coldness of the two steel pistols in his pockets. It had stopped snowing. The moon grew brighter and brighter,
emerging from the mists, and its light mingled with the white reflection of the fallen snow, giving the room a twilight feel. There was light in the Jondrette dung heap. Marius saw a red gleam shining through the hole in the wall, which looked like it was bleeding. He was sure that this gleam could scarcely be produced by a candle. Otherwise, there was no movement at the Jondrettes. No one was stirring there, or talking. Not a breath. The silence was glacial and profound, and without the red light, you would have thought you were next to a tomb. Marius quietly took off his boots and pushed them under the bed. A few minutes went by. Marius heard the door below turn on its hinges. A heavy, quick tread mounted the stairs and came along the hallway. The latch of the rat hole clicked open. Jondrette was back. Immediately, several voices rose. The whole family was in the garret. They simply kept quiet in the absence of the master, the way wolf cubs do in the absence of the wolf. "'Tis I," he said.
"Good evening, puppy,"
yelped the daughters.
"Well,"
said their mother.
"It's all coming along nicely," replied Jondrette, "but my feet are frozen." "Ah, good, that's it. I see you're all dolled up. You have to be able to inspire trust."
"All ready to go."
"You won't forget anything I told you? You'll do everything right?"
"Don't you worry about that. It's just that—"
Jondrette started to say, but he didn't finish his sentence. Marius heard him put something heavy on the table, probably the chisel he'd bought.
"Ah, right," Jondrette said. "Have you had something to eat?"
"Yes," said the mother. "I had 3 big potatoes with salt. I made use of the fire to cook them."
"Good," said Jondrette. "Tomorrow I'll take you out to dinner. We'll have duck with all the trimmings. You're dying like Charles X. Things are going well."
Then he added, in a lowered voice, "The mousetrap's set. The cats are ready to pounce." He lowered his voice further still.
"Put this on the fire."
Marius heard the clatter of charcoal being knocked by tongs or some other iron instrument, and Jondrette continued.
"Did you oil the door hinges so they won't make a noise?"
"Yes,"
said the mother.
"What time is it?"
"Getting on for 6. It's just struck the half hour at Saint-Médard."
"Jesus," said Jondrette. "It's time for the girls to get going if they're going to keep watch. Over here, you two, listen carefully."
There was a bout of whispering, then Jondrette spoke up again. "Has Mother Bougon gone?"
"Yes,"
said the woman.
"Are you sure there's no one home next door?"
"He hasn't come back all day, and you know this is the time he has his dinner."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
"All the same," said Jondrette, "no harm going round to check. Girlie, take the candle and pop next door."
Marius dropped to his hands and knees and crawled silently under the bed. He had only just curled up under it when he saw a light through the cracks in his door.
"Pa," a voice cried, "he's out."
He recognized the voice of the elder daughter.
"Did you go in?"
asked the father.
"No," answered the girl, "but his key's in the door, so he's out."
The father yelled,
"Go in just the same."
The door opened, and Marius saw the big Jondrette girl come in, candle in hand. She was the same as she had been that morning, but even more frightening by candlelight. She went straight to the bed. Marius had a moment of horrible panic, but by the bed there was a mirror nailed to the wall, and that was where she was headed. She stretched up on tiptoes and looked at herself. You could hear the noise of scrap iron being moved around in the room next door as she smoothed her hair with the palm of her hand and smiled in the mirror, softly crooning in her deathly broken voice,
"Our love lasted 1 whole week of heaven. But how short such moments of bliss! It was well worth it, joy times 7. Love should last forever like this. Should last forever. Should last forever."
Marius was shaking all the while. He could not believe that she could not hear him breathing. She went to the window and looked out, talking to herself out loud, with that half-mad look of hers.
"God, Paris is ugly when it puts on its white chemise," she said.
She returned to the mirror and made faces once more, studying herself first face on, then in profile.
"Hey," yelled the father, "what the hell are you doing?" "I'm looking under the bed and behind the furniture," she answered, continuing to arrange her hair. "There's nobody here." "Halfwit,"
shrieked the father. "Get in here this minute. We've got no time to waste." "I'm coming, I'm coming," she said. "A girl doesn't have time to scratch herself in this dump."
She hummed. "You leave me to find fame one day, my sad heart will follow you all the way." She cast a last glance in the mirror and left, shutting the door behind her. A moment later, Marius heard the noise of the two girls padding down the hallway in their bare feet, and Jondrette's voice shouting after them, "Be very careful! One over at the barrière, the other at the corner of the Rue du Petit Banquier. Don't lose sight of the front door for a second. And if you see anything at all, I want you back here on the double. Up to it! You've got a key to get back in." The elder daughter grumbled, "Fancy keeping watch barefoot in the snow. Tomorrow you'll have little scarab-colored silk ankle boots," yelled the father. They went downstairs, and a few seconds later the front door banged shut, announcing that they were now outside. There was no one left in the house except Marius and the Jondrette couple, and probably also the mysterious beings glimpsed by Marius in the gloom behind the door of the vacant garret. Marius's 5-franc piece put to use. Marius judged that the moment had come to resume his place at his observation post. In the blink of an eye, and with all the suppleness of a young man, he was back at the hole in the wall. He peered in. The interior of the Jondrette dwelling looked weirdly different. Marius could now see what was causing the strange light he had noticed. A candle was burning in a candlestick green with verdigris, but that was not what was really lighting the room. The whole rat hole was lit up by the glare from a big cast-iron stove parked in the fireplace and filled with burning charcoal, the stove that Mother Jondrette had worked on that morning. The charcoal was burning, and the stove was red-hot, with a blue flame dancing inside. By its light you could pick out the shape of the chisel Jondrette had bought in the Rue Pierre Lombard, thrust into the burning coals and now glowing red. In a corner near the door, arranged as for some anticipated use, there were two mounds, one a heap of old scrap iron, the other a heap of ropes. Anyone who didn't know what was in the works would have been in two minds at seeing all this, and would have wavered between a very sinister interpretation and a perfectly straightforward one. Lit up the way it was, the dump looked more a forge than the mouth of hell. But in this light, Jondrette looked more like a demon than a blacksmith. The heat of the burning coals was so great that the candle on the table was melting fast and had burned right down on the side nearest the stove. An old Chinese lantern made of copper, worthy of a Diogenes, turned housebreaker like cartouche, had been placed on the mantelpiece. The stove had been placed on the hearth itself, next to the mostly extinguished embers, and it was sending its steam straight up through the chimney flue without spreading any odor. The moon came in through the 4 panes of the window, throwing its whiteness into the flaming crimson garret. And to the poetic mind of Marius, dreamer that he was even at the moment of action, it was like a beam from heaven spilling into the grotesque fantasies of earth. A gust of air whooshed in through the broken pane and helped disperse the smell of burning coal and hide the stove. The Jondrette lair was, if you recall what we said earlier about the old Gorbeau building, admirably well chosen to serve as the theatre of a very dark and dirty deed and for staging a crime. It was the most remote room in the house, the one farthest away from the most deserted boulevard in Paris. If this ambush had not already been planned, someone would have invented it there. The whole thickness of a house and a host of vacant rooms separated this rat hole from the boulevard, and its only window looked out on vast wastelands blocked off behind walls and paling fences. Jondrette had lit his pipe and was sitting on the chair with the straw seat kicked out, smoking. His wife was talking to him in a voice just above a whisper. If Marius had been Courfeyrac, that is, one of those people who laugh at every occasion life throws up, he'd have burst out laughing when his eye lit on Mother Jondrette. She was wearing a black hat with feathers not unlike one of the hats of the heralds at arms at Charlotte Dix's consecration, an immense tartan shawl over her wool-knit skirt, and the man's shoes her daughter had turned her nose up at that morning. It was this get-up that had caused Jondrette to let out his exclamation, "Good, that's it, I see you're all dolled up.
you have to be able to inspire trust. As for Jondrette, he had not quit the overcoat, new and far too big for him, that Monsieur Leblanc had given him, and his outfit continued to offer that contrast between overcoat and trousers that constituted the ideal of the poet, in Courfeyrac's view. All of a sudden, Jondrette raised his voice. "Hang on! I've just thought of something. In this lousy weather, he'll come in a cab. Light the lantern and go down with it. Stay there behind the front door. The moment you hear the cab stop, open up straight away. He'll come up. You'll light the stairs and the hall, and when he comes in here, go straight back down again and pay the driver and send the cab on its way."
"What about the money?" asked the woman.
Jondrette fumbled in his pants and handed her 5 francs.
"What's that?" she cried.
Jondrette replied, with dignity, "It's the monarch the neighbor gave us this morning." And he added, "Know what? We need 2 chairs in here."
"What for?"
"To sit on." Marius felt a shiver run down his spine when he heard Mother Jondrette answer calmly,
"Christ, I'll go and get the neighbors for you."
And she swiftly opened the door of the rat hole and went out into the hall. Marius did not physically have the time to get down off the chest of drawers, run to the bed and hide.
"Take the candle,"
yelled Jondrette.
"No," she said. "I've only got 2 hands and I've got 2 chairs to carry. The moon's out."
Marius heard Mother Jondrette's heavy hand groping for his key in the dark. The door opened. He remained rooted to the spot in shock and astonishment. Mother Jondrette came in. The dormer window let in a ray of moonlight between 2 great blocks of shadow. One of the blocks of shadow covered the whole wall that Marius was leaning against in such a way that he disappeared. Mother Jondrette looked up, did not see Marius, took the 2 chairs, the only ones Marius owned, and went out again, letting the door shut with a bang behind her. She resurfaced in the rat hole.
"Here's the 2 chairs.
And here's the lantern," said the husband. "Go down, quick." She rushed to obey, and Jondrette was left on his own. He arranged the 2 chairs on either side of the table, turned the chisel in the fire, put an old screen in front of the fireplace to hide the stove, then went over to the corner where the pile of ropes was, and bent down as though to examine something there. Marius then saw that what he had taken for a shapeless heap was a rope ladder very well made, with wooden rungs and 2 large hooks for hanging. This ladder, and a few large tools, veritable iron clubs which were jumbled in with the scrap iron heaped behind the door, had not been in the Jondrette hole that morning, and had evidently been brought in during the afternoon while Marius was out.
"Those are edge tool maker's tools," thought Marius.
If Marius had been a bit better informed in this line, he would have recognized that what he took for the stock in trade of the edge tool maker was actually either instruments able to force a door or pick a lock, or ones able to cut and slice, the 2 families of sinister implements that thieves know as juniors and reapers. The fireplace and the table with the 2 chairs sat exactly facing Marius. With the stove hidden, the room was now illuminated by the candle alone, and the tiniest object on the table or mantelpiece cast a huge shadow. A water jug with a broken neck covered half a wall. There was a heavy, menacing calm in the room. You could feel that something appalling, beyond words, was building. Jondrette had let his pipe go out, a serious sign of intense preoccupation, and had come and sat back down again. The candle brought out the sharp angles of his face in all their savageness. He kept frowning furiously and abruptly opening his right hand as though responding to the final counsel of some somber inner monologue. In one of these obscure replies he was giving himself, he swiftly pulled out the table drawer, took out a long kitchen knife that was hidden there, and tested the blade on a fingernail. That done, he put the knife back in the drawer and pushed it shut. Marius himself took hold of the pistol that was in his right fob pocket, pulled it out, and cocked it. As he cocked it, the pistol made a small, clear, sharp sound. Jondrette jumped and half rose from his chair. "Who's there?" he shouted. Marius held his breath. Jondrette listened for a second, then started to laugh.
"What an idiot I am! It's only the wall creaking."
Marius kept the pistol in his hand.
The face-off of Marius's two chairs. All of a sudden, the distant and melancholy ringing of a bell rattled the windows. 6 o'clock rang out at Saint-Médard. Jondrette marked each stroke with a nod of the head. At the 6th stroke, he snuffed out the candle with his fingers. Then he began to circle the room, listened in the hall, walked a bit, listened again. "He'd better turn up," he growled, before returning to his chair. He had only just sat down again when the door opened. Mother Jondrette had opened it but remained in the hall, her face frozen in a hideous grimace of hospitality that one of the slits in the Chinese lantern lit from below.
"Come in, monsieur," she said.
"Come in, my benefactor," Jondrette repeated, shooting to his feet.
Monsieur Leblanc appeared. He had an air of serenity that made him strangely venerable. He laid 4 louis on the table.
"Monsieur Fabantou," he said, "that is for your rent and your immediate needs. We'll see to the rest later."
"May God reward you, my generous benefactor," said Jondrette, before rushing to his wife and whispering in her ear, "Send the cab away."
She slipped away while her husband was bowing extravagantly and offering Monsieur Leblanc a chair. A moment later she returned and whispered in his ear, "Done." The snow that had not stopped falling all day was now so thick that none of them had heard the fiacre arrive, and they did not hear it leave. Meanwhile, Monsieur Leblanc had taken a seat. Jondrette had taken possession of the other chair opposite Monsieur Leblanc. Now, to truly grasp the scene that is about to unfold, the reader needs to get a clear picture of the freezing cold night, the vast expanses of La Salpêtrière covered in snow and looking as white in the moonlight as immense winding sheets, the dim light of the street lamps creating fuzzy, reddish pools of light here and there along the mournful boulevards, and the long rows of black elms, not a living being out perhaps for a mile around, the old Gorbeau slum at its most intense pitch of silence, horror, and blackness. And inside this slum, in the middle of those expanses, in the middle of that darkness, the cavernous Jondrette garret lit by a single candle. And inside this dump, two men seated at a table, Monsieur Leblanc calm and tranquil, Jondrette smiling and terrifying, Mother Jondrette, the she-wolf, in a corner and on the other side of the dividing wall, Marius, on his feet, invisible, not missing a word, not missing a movement, his eye at the peephole, his pistol firmly in his grip. Marius, in fact, felt only the emotion of horror, not fear. He held the butt of the pistol tightly and felt reassured. "I'll stop this miserable bastard when I'm good and ready," he thought. He could sense that the police were there somewhere, lying in ambush, waiting for the agreed signal, and ready to leap into action. He hoped, too, that from this violent encounter between Jondrette and Monsieur Leblanc, some light would be shed on all it was in his interests to find out.
Dealing with the darkest depths. No sooner had Monsieur Leblanc sat down than he turned his eyes toward the pallets, which were empty.
"How is the poor little injured girl faring?" he asked.
"Badly," answered Jondrette, with a terribly distressed and grateful smile. "Very badly, my worthy monsieur. Her older sister has taken her to the hospital in the Rue Bourbe to be bandaged. You will see them. They will be back shortly."
"Madame Fabantou looks to me to be much better," Monsieur Leblanc pursued, casting his eyes over the bizarre get-up of Mother Jondrette, who was standing between him and the door as though already guarding the exit, and studying him in a threatening, almost a fighting stance.
"She is dying," said Jondrette. "But what can you do, monsieur? She has so much courage, that woman. She's not a woman. She's an ox."
Mother Jondrette, touched by the compliment, protested with the affected simpering of a flattered monster,
"You are too kind, Monsieur Jondrette."
"Jondrette?" said Monsieur Leblanc. "I thought your name was Fabantou."
"Fabantou, alias Jondrette," the husband hastened to reply. "My stage name."
And giving his wife a shrug that Monsieur Leblanc did not see, he continued in a histrionic yet oily voice,
"It's just that we have always gotten on so well together, that poor old darling, and yours truly. What would we have left if it weren't for that? Ours is a sorry lot, my estimable sir. We've got the hands, but no labor. We've got the heart, but no work. I don't know how the government does it, but on my word of honor, monsieur, I'm no Jacobin, monsieur, I'm no troublemaker. I don't wish them any harm, but if I were the ministers, on my most sacred word, it'd be a very different story. Listen, here's an example. I wanted my girls to learn packing as a trade. You'll say to me, what? A trade? Yes, a trade, a simple trade, a living. What a fall, my benefactor, what degradation when you've been what we were. Alas, nothing's left of our days of prosperity. Nothing but one thing, a painting I'm very fond of, which I'd part with if I had to, though, for a person's got to live. I say again, a person's got to live.
While Jondrette was rapping on incoherently, in a way that sat oddly with the cool, calm, and collected expression on his face, Marius looked up and saw someone he had not yet seen at the back of the room. A man had come in, so quietly no one had heard the door turning on its hinges. This man had on a violet knitted waistcoat that was old, worn through, stained, cut off at the bottom, and gaping at the seams, baggy corduroy pants, and, on his feet, soft-soled slippers. He had no shirt. His neck was bare. His arms were bare except for tattoos. And his face was daubed in black. He had sat down in silence with his arms folded on the nearest bed, and as he was sitting behind Mother Jondrette, you could only dimly make him out. The kind of magnetic instinct that alerts the eye made Monsieur Leblanc turn round almost at the same time as Marius. He could not help but give a start of surprise that did not escape Jondrette.
"Ah, I see," cried Jondrette, buttoning himself up with an air of complacency. "You've noticed your overcoat. It suits me. My faith, it suits me down to the ground."
"Who is that man?" said Monsieur Leblanc.
"That?" said Jondrette. "He's one of the neighbors. Don't take any notice."
The neighbor had a most peculiar appearance. But factories producing chemicals abound in the Faubourg Saint-Marceau, and a lot of factory workers get their faces blackened. Monsieur Leblanc's whole person, moreover, gave off a frank and fearless confidence. He went on. "Pardon me, what were you saying, Monsieur Fabantou?"
"I was saying, monsieur, dear patron," Jondrette resumed, leaning on the table and contemplating Monsieur Leblanc with steady and tender eyes, not unlike the eyes of a boa constrictor. "I was saying that I had a painting for sale."
A slight noise sounded at the door. A second man came in and sat on the bed behind Mother Jondrette. He, like the first, had bare arms and a mask of ink or soot. Although the man had literally slipped into the room, he could not prevent Monsieur Leblanc from spotting him.
"Don't mind them," said Jondrette. "They live in the place. So, as I was saying, I still have a painting. One precious painting left. Look, monsieur, see."
He got up, went to the wall where the panel we mentioned before was leaning, and turned it round the right way, though leaving it standing against the wall. The thing did actually resemble a painting, which the candle vaguely revealed. Marius couldn't see much, Jondrette having come between him and it. All he could make out was a splotchy background and a sort of central character colored in with the garish crudeness of fairground banners and screen paintings. "What on earth is that?" asked Monsieur Leblanc. Jondrette exclaimed,
"An old master, a very valuable picture, my benefactor. I'm as fond of it as I am of my two daughters. It brings back such memories. But I said it before, and I'll say it again. I'm down on my luck at present, so I'm willing to part with it."
Either by chance, or because he was beginning to smell a rat, Monsieur Leblanc's gaze went to the back of the room while he examined the painting. There were now four men there, three sitting on the bed, one standing by the door, all four bare-armed, motionless, their faces painted black. One of the three on the bed was leaning against the wall with his eyes closed,
and you would have sworn he was asleep. This particular man was old. The sight of his white hair on top of his black face was shocking. The other two seemed young. One of them had a beard, the other long hair. None had shoes. Those who didn't have socks were barefoot. Jondrette noticed that Monsieur Leblanc was staring at the men.
"They're friends. They live around here," he said. "They're all black because they work in coal. They're chimney specialists. Don't you worry about them, my benefactor, but do buy my painting. Take pity on me and my misery. I'll give you a good price. What do you reckon it's worth?"
"But," said Monsieur Leblanc, staring hard at Jondrette now, as though he was beginning to be on his guard, "it's just some cabaret sign. It's worth all of 3 francs. Jondrette replied sweetly, "Do you have your wallet with you? I'll be happy with 1,000 écus. Monsieur Leblanc got to his feet, put his back to the wall, and swiftly ran his eye around the room. He had Jondrette on his left on the window side, and Mother Jondrette and the 4 men on his right on the door side. The 4 men did not move a muscle and looked as though they hadn't even seen him. Jondrette had begun talking in a whining tone again, with such a clouded look in his eyes and in such a woeful manner that Monsieur Leblanc could believe that the man he had before him had, quite simply, gone mad with misery. "If you don't buy my painting, dear benefactor," Jondrette wailed, "I'll be without resources. There'll be nothing left for me to do but throw myself in the river. When I think I wanted my 2 girls to go into the packing industry, making cardboard gift boxes for New Year's Day. All very well, but you have to have a table with a special panel at the bottom so the glass jars don't fall on the floor. You have to have a specially built stove, a pot with 3 compartments for heating the glue to the different degrees of strength it has to be, depending on whether it's used for wood, paper, or fabric. You have to have cutters to cut the cardboard, molds to shape it, hammers to nail in the bits of steel, chisels and pincers, heaven knows what else. And all that just to earn 4 sous a day. For 14 hours' work, and every box passes through the worker's hands 13 times, and you've got to keep the paper wet, and you can't get anything dirty, and you've got to keep the glue hot. It's hell, I tell you, all for a lousy 4 sous a day. How do you expect him to live?" While he spoke, Jondrette was looking away from Monsieur Leblanc, who was watching him closely. Monsieur Leblanc's eyes were riveted on Jondrette, and Jondrette's eyes were riveted on the door. Marius's breathless attention swung from one to the other. Monsieur Leblanc appeared to be wondering if the man was a certain cretin. Jondrette repeated 2 or 3 times, using all sorts of tonal variations within the same imploring, drawling style, "There's nothing left for me to do but throw myself in the river. The other day I went down 3 steps over by the Pont d'Austerlitz with that in mind." Suddenly his dull eyes blazed with a hideous fire. The little man straightened up and became terrifying. He took a step toward Monsieur Leblanc and bellowed at him in a thundering voice, "But never mind all that. Don't you recognize me?" The ambush. The door of the garret had just swung open abruptly and revealed 3 men in blue canvas smocks wearing masks of black paper. The first was skinny and had a long cudgel with an iron tip. The second was a sort of colossus, carrying a poleaxe for slaughtering cattle, holding it by the middle of the handle with the hatchet part pointing downward. The third, a man with big, broad shoulders, was bigger than the first, but not as massive as the second, and he was holding an enormous key stolen from some prison or other in his clenched fist. It looked as if it was the arrival of these men that Jondrette had been waiting for. A rapid dialogue broke out between him and the man with the cudgel, the skinny one. "Everything ready?" asked Jondrette.
"Yes," answered the thin man.
"Where's Montparnasse, then?"
"The juvenile lead stopped for a bit of a chinwag with your daughter."
"Which one?"
"The big one."
"Is there a cab down below?"
"Yes. The old rattle-trap's hitched." "It's hitched."
"2 good horses?"
"The best."
"Waiting where I said to wait?"
"Yes."
"Good," said Jondrette. Monsieur Leblanc was very pale. He looked everything over in the dump around him like a man who has finally realized where he has landed, and as he slowly turned his head to study the faces of all the men surrounding him, his movement showed alert amazement, but there was nothing in his manner that remotely resembled fear. Using the table as a makeshift entrenchment, this man, who only a moment before looked like nothing more than a nice old gent,
suddenly became a sort of athlete as he gripped the back of his chair with his powerful fist in a surprising and frightening gesture. This old man, so strong and so brave in the face of such danger, looked to be one of those people who are as courageous as they are good, easily and simply. The father of a woman that we love is never a stranger for us. Marius felt proud of this man he didn't know. Three of the bare-armed men Jondrette had described as chimney specialists had delved into the pile of scrap iron, one extracting some very large shears, another a pair of weighing tongs, the third a hammer, and they had then ranged themselves across the doorway without a word. The old one stayed where he was on the bed and merely opened his eyes. Mother Jondrette was sitting next to him. Marius knew that the moment to intervene would arrive in a matter of seconds, and he raised his right hand toward the ceiling, in the direction of the hall, ready to let fly with a pistol shot. Jondrette had finished his confabulation with the man with the cudgel, and he now turned once more to Monsieur Leblanc and repeated his question, this time to the accompaniment of that awful, low, choking laugh of his.
"So you really don't recognize me, then?"
Monsieur Leblanc looked at him in the face and answered, "No." Jondrette then bounded over to the table, leaned over the candle, folded his arms, and thrust his fierce, angular jaw at the calm face of Monsieur Leblanc as closely as he could without Monsieur Leblanc's stepping back, and, in this posture of a feral animal about to bite, he shouted,
"My name is not Fabantou. My name is not Jondrette. My name is Thénardier. I am the innkeeper of Montfermeil. Do you hear me? Thénardier! Now do you recognize me?"
An imperceptible flush passed over Monsieur Leblanc's face, but he answered with his usual placidity, in his usual soft, steady voice, "No more than before." Marius did not hear this reply. Anyone seeing him at that moment in the dark would have seen how wild-eyed, staggered, and stunned he had become. The moment Jondrette said, "My name is Thénardier," Marius's whole body had started shaking, and he had fallen back against the wall as though he'd felt the cold blade of a sword run through his heart. Then his right arm, raised, ready to release the signal shot, slowly dropped. And the moment Jondrette shouted, "Do you hear me? Thénardier!" Marius's failing fingers had nearly let go of the pistol. Jondrette, by revealing who he was, had not shaken Monsieur Leblanc, but he had shattered Marius. The name Thénardier, which Monsieur Leblanc did not seem to know, was known to Marius. Remember what the name meant to him. He had worn it over his heart, written as it was in his father's will. He wore it at the back of his mind, in the depths of his memory, in the form of this sacred command: "A man named Thénardier saved my life. If my son should meet him, he will do all he can for him." This name, as you will recall, had become an article of faith for him, engraved in his soul. He associated it with his father's name in religious worship. And now, here he was. Here was this Thénardier. Here was this innkeeper from Montfermeil he had searched for, high and low, in vain for so long. He had at last found him. And how? This, his father's savior, was a crook. This man to whom he, Marius, burned to dedicate himself, was a monster. This Colonel Pontmercy's liberator was in the process of committing some crime whose actual form Marius could not yet make out clearly, but which looked like murder. And murder of whom? Good God! What a cursed fate! What a bitter mockery of fate! His father commanded him from beyond the grave to do everything he could for Thénardier. For 4 years Marius had thought of nothing but how to acquit himself of his father's debt. And now, at the very moment he was about to deliver a brigand in the middle of perpetrating a crime to the legal authorities, destiny screamed at him, "But it's Thénardier!" When at last he could pay back the man who had saved his father's life on the heroic field of Waterloo in a storm of grapeshot, he was going to pay him back by delivering him to the scaffold. He had promised himself that if he ever were to find this Thénardier, he would simply throw himself at his feet. And now, he had actually found him, but only to hand him over to the executioner. His father said to him, "Help Thénardier," and he was to answer this adored and saintly voice by destroying Thénardier. His father would turn in his grave at the spectacle of the man who had snatched him from the jaws of death, at his own peril, executed in the Place Saint-Jacques through the interventions of the son to whom he had bequeathed the man. What a mockery to have so long worn over his breast his father's last wishes,
written in his own hand, just to do the complete opposite so vilely. But on the other hand, how could he witness this ambush and not stop it? Hell, how could he condemn the victim and spare the assassin? Could you be bound in any shape or form of gratitude to such a miserable bastard? All the ideas Marius had entertained for the last 4 years were smashed to smithereens by this unexpected blow. He shuddered. It all depended on him. He held all these people in the palm of his hand, unbeknownst to them, as they jerked about under his nose. If he fired a shot, Monsieur Leblanc would be saved and Thénardier sunk. If he didn't shoot, Monsieur Leblanc would be sacrificed and, who knows, Thénardier might get away. To send one down or drop the other. Remorse either way. What was he to do? Which should he choose? To fail his most imperious memories? All those deep commitments he had made to himself, the most sacred duty, the most venerated text? To fail his father's will? Or let a crime go ahead? It seemed to him that on one side he could hear his Ursula imploring him to save her father, and on the other, the colonel commending Thénardier to his care. He felt as if he were going mad. His knees were buckling under him, and there was no time to decide anyway, for the drama was racing ahead furiously, even as he looked on. It was like a whirlwind which he thought he controlled, but which was suddenly sweeping him away. He was on the point of passing out. Meanwhile, Thénardier, we will call him that and nothing else from now on, was pacing up and down in front of the table in a sort of panicky, triumphant frenzy. He wrapped his fist round the candle and plunked it down on the mantelpiece with such a violent thud that the wick nearly went out and hot wax flew over the wall. Then he wheeled round on Monsieur Leblanc, frightening, and spat out these words, "The jig's up! Your goose is cooked! I'll have you for dinner!" With that, he started pacing again, erupting like a volcano as he did so. "Ah!" he cried. "At last I've caught up with you again, Monsieur the Philanthropist! Monsieur the threadbare millionaire, Monsieur the giver of dolls, old numbskull. Ah, so you don't recognize me? No, I suppose you're not the one who came to Montfermeil, to my inn 8 years ago, the night before Christmas 1823. You're not the one who took Fantine's kid, the lark from us. You're not the one who used to go around in a yellow coachman's greatcoat. Oh, no, not you. You even had a parcel of clothes in your hand, just like here this morning. Tell me now, woman, it's a mania with him, it looks like, to carry parcels stuffed with blasted woolen stockings to other people's houses. Charitable old bastard, aren't you? Are you in the hosiery business by any chance? Monsieur Millionaire, you palm off the stuff you can't sell on the poor saintly man. What a charlatan! Ah, you don't recognize me? Well, I recognize you. I recognize you right off as soon as you stuck your nose in the door. Ah, at last, you're about to see that it's not all roses, poking around other people's places like that, just because they happen to be inns, decked out in lousy old clothes, looking like such a pauper that you'd have given him a coin, pulling the wool over a person's eyes, acting the generous one, and then taking their livelihoods away and making threats out in the woods. You'll see it's not enough that you come back later, when the people are ruined, bringing a dirty great overcoat that's too big for a person, and a couple of flea-bitten hospital blankets, you old rogue, you old child-snatcher. He stopped, and appeared to be talking to himself for a moment. You would have said his fury was subsiding like the Rhone, rushing down some hole. Then, as he finished off out loud the things he had been muttering to himself under his breath, he brought his fist down on the table and shouted, "And he looks so easy-going, too!" And he yelled at Monsieur Leblanc, "Jesus wept! You had a good laugh at me back then, eh? You're the cause of all my woes! For 1,500 francs, you got hold of a girl I had, who certainly had wealthy connections. She'd already brought me in a lot of cash, and when I was supposed to make enough out of her to live on all my life. A girl who would have paid me back for all I lost in that lousy flea-pit of a pothouse where they made such a royal racket and where I ate up all my assets like a fool. Oh, I wish all the wine they drank in that dive was poisoned to the swine who drank it. But never mind. So, tell me, you must have thought I was a real idiot when you went off with the lark. You had your cudgel tucked away in the forest. You were the strongest then. Well, it's time for revenge. I hold the winning cards today. You're done for, my good man. Oh, but I have to laugh. I do have to laugh. Look how he fell into the trap. I told him I was a performer, that my name was Fabantou, that I'd been on stage with Mademoiselle Mars and Mademoiselle Mich, that my landlord wanted to be paid tomorrow, the 4th of February, and he didn't even twig that it's the 8th of January and not the 4th of February. That's the last day of the quarter. Brainless goose. And what about the four lousy Philippe he brings me?
Louse! He wasn't even big enough to go up to 100 francs. And the way he went along with my platitudes, I enjoyed that bit. I said to myself, silly old goat, go on. I've got you by the short and curlies now. I was licking your ass this morning, but I'm going to be chomping on your heart tonight.
Thénardier stopped. He was out of breath. His narrow little chest was heaving like a smithy's bellows. His eyes were full of the ignoble jubilation of a weak, cruel, and cowardly creature, when it finally manages to bring to ground what it has feared and insult what it has flattered, the joy of a dwarf stamping on Goliath's head, the joy of a jackal as it tucks into a sick bull, dead enough not to defend itself, alive enough to suffer still. Monsieur Leblanc did not cut him off. But when he cut himself off, he said, I don't know what you're talking about. You are mistaken. I'm a very poor man, anything but a millionaire. I don't know you. You have me mixed up with someone else.
Ah, groaned Thénardier, what garbage. You're sticking to your little story, are you? You're talking hogwash, old man. You don't remember, eh? You don't see who I am?
Pardon me, monsieur, answered Monsieur Leblanc in a polite tone that, at such a moment, had a strange and powerful effect. I see that you are a crook. As we have all noticed, even the vilest beings have their susceptibilities. Monsters are touchy. At the word crook, Mother Thénardier shot up from the bed. Thénardier grabbed his chair as though he was about to break it in two with his bare hands.
Don't you move!
He yelled at his wife. Then he turned to Monsieur Leblanc.
A crook? Yes, I know that's what you call us, you rich folk. Listen, it's true, I went bust. I'm now in hiding. I don't have a crust of bread. I don't have a sou. I'm a crook, all right. It's 3 days since I've eaten. I'm a crook. Ha! You keep your feet warm, you lot. You've got your fancy Sikorsky loafers. You've got your padded overcoats like archbishops. You live on the first floor of houses that have porters. You eat truffles. You eat whole bunches of asparagus at 40 francs a bunch in the month of January. Green peas. You stuff your faces, and when you want to know if it's cold out, you look in the newspaper to see what it says on the thermometer of Chevalier the Engineer. Us lot, we're our own thermometers. We don't need to go and stand on the quay at the corner of the Tour de l'Horloge to see how many degrees below zero it is. We feel our blood freeze in our veins, and ice bite into our hearts, and we say, there is no God. And you come creeping into our sties, yes, our sties, and call us crooks. But we will eat you. You poor little things, we will devour you. Monsieur Millionaire, let me tell you this. I was once set up in business. I was licensed. I was a voter. I'm a respectable citizen, I am. You, perhaps, are not.
Here Thénardier took a step toward the men near the door and added, shaking,
when I think he's got the nerve to come here and speak to me as if I was a cobbler.
Then he rounded on Monsieur Leblanc in a fresh burst of frenzy.
And let me tell you this, too, Monsieur Philanthropist. I'm no sleazy sluggard, that I am not. I'm not some nonentity without a name who slinks into other people's houses and kidnaps children. I was once a French soldier. I'm a blasted veteran. I ought to be decorated. I was at Waterloo, you hear? And in that battle I saved a general called Count someone or other. He told me his name, but his lousy voice was so weak I didn't catch it. All I heard was mercy, merci. I'd have preferred his name to this merci caper. Thanks, but no thanks. His name would have helped me find him again. This painting you see here, which was painted by David at Bruxelles, do you know who it's a painting of? Yours truly. David wanted to immortalize that feat of arms. I've got the general on my back, and I'm carrying him through the grape shot. That's the story. He never even did anything for me, that particular general, never. He was no better than the rest of you. It didn't stop me from saving his life, but at the risk of losing my own. And I've got documents to prove it coming out of my pockets. I am a soldier of Waterloo, for crying out loud, and now that I've had the goodness to tell you all that, let's get it over with. I need money. I need a lot of money. I need an enormous amount of money, or I'll exterminate you, come hell or high water.
Marius had managed to subdue his anguish and was listening hard. The last shred of doubt had now evaporated. This was, indeed, the Thénardier of the will. Marius winced at the man's attack on his father for ingratitude, which he had come fatally close to denying out loud. His confusion spiraled. Besides, in all Thénardier's words, in his tone, in his gestures, in his crazily flashing eyes, flaring at every word, in the whole explosion, an evil nature was on show, parading openly in a mix of bravado and abjectness, pride and pettiness, rage and silliness, in this whole chaotic jumble of real grievances and sham emotions, in the shamelessness of a vicious criminal savoring the voluptuous pleasure of violence, in this brazen nakedness of an ugly soul exposed to view, this conflagration of extreme suffering combined with extreme hate, in all of this, there was something hideous like evil, yet poignant like truth. The masterwork, this painting by David, that he had proposed Monsieur Leblanc by, was nothing other, as the reader will have guessed, than the sign from his old pothouse, painted, as you will recall, by the man himself, the sole bit of flotsam that he had saved from his shipwreck at Montfermeil. As he had stopped blocking Marius's line of sight, Marius could now study the thing, and in this mess of paint he actually could make out a battle, a background of smoke, and a man carrying another man. It was the group formed by Thénardier and Pontmercy, the savior sergeant and the colonel he had saved. Marius more or less went into a delirium. The painting somehow restored his father to life, and it suddenly stopped being the sign from the Montfermeil tavern to become a resurrection. In it, a grave cracked open, a phantom rose to its feet. Marius could hear his blood thumping at his temples. He had the cannon of Waterloo in his ears. His bleeding father, dimly painted on that sinister panel, terrified him. He felt as though that amorphous blob was staring straight at him. When Thénardier had gotten his breath back, he trained his bloodshot eyes on Monsieur Leblanc and said to him in a tight, low voice, "What have you got to say before we get to work on you?" Monsieur Leblanc said nothing. In the middle of this silence, a hoarse voice threw in a grimly sarcastic remark from the hallway. "If you need any wood chopped, don't forget I'm here." It was the man with the poleaxe having fun. At the same time, an enormous, dirty, bristly face bobbed up at the door with a hideous grin that showed not teeth but fangs. It was the face of the man with the poleaxe. "Why'd you take your mask off?" Thénardier barked at him in fury. "So's I could laugh," the man replied. For some moments, Monsieur Leblanc had apparently been closely following every move Thénardier made, while the latter, blinded and dazed as he was by his own rage, confidently stomped up and down the lair, knowing that the door was guarded and that nine armed men held one unarmed man captive, assuming Mother Thénardier counted as only one man herself. As he shouted at the man with the poleaxe, he turned his back on Monsieur Leblanc. Monsieur Leblanc seized the moment. He kicked the chair away with his foot, pushed the table away with his fist, and, in a single bound, with wonderful agility, before Thénardier had time to turn round, he was at the window. It took him only a second to open it, hop onto the sill, and step over. He was halfway out when six powerful fists grabbed him and yanked him violently back into the hole. The three chimney specialists had hurled themselves at him. At the same time, Mother Thénardier had grabbed hold of his hair. At the sound of a scuffle, the other thugs came running from the hallway. The old man on the bed, apparently half drunk, got off the pallet and staggered over with a road mender's hammer in his hand. One of the chimney specialists, whose candle lit up his smeared face, and in whom Marius, despite the smear of paint, recognized Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, raised over Monsieur Leblanc's head a sort of club consisting of an iron bar with a knob of lead at each end. Marius could hold out no longer. "Father," he silently prayed, "forgive me." And his finger sought the trigger of the pistol. He was just about to fire a shot when Thénardier's voice rang out, "Don't hurt him!" The victim's desperate bid to escape, far from exasperating Thénardier, had calmed him down. There were two men in Thénardier, the vicious thug and the crafty intriguer. Till that moment, in the first flush of triumph, with the prey brought down and no longer moving, the vicious thug had dominated. When the victim resisted and seemed to want to fight back, the crafty intriguer reappeared and took over. "Don't hurt him," he repeated. He didn't know it, of course, but the first positive result for him of this shift
was to stop the cocked pistol from going off and to paralyze Marius, for whom the urgency disappeared. Faced with this new development, Marius could not see what was wrong with waiting a bit longer. Who was to say that some stroke of luck would not intervene and save him from the ghastly alternatives of letting Ursula's father perish or sinking the savior of his own father, the colonel? A Herculean struggle had begun. With a direct punch in the guts, Monsieur Leblanc had sent the old man flying to the middle of the room. Then, with two backhanders, he knocked two other assailants to the ground and pinned them, one under each of his knees. The poor scoundrels groaned under the pressure as though they were being squashed by a granite millstone. But the four others had seized the formidable old man by both arms and by the neck and were holding him hunched over the two flattened chimney specialists. And so, mastering some and mastered by others, crushing those below and suffocating under those above, vainly endeavoring to shake off the blows raining down on him, Monsieur Leblanc disappeared beneath this horrible pile of thugs like a wild boar under a howling pack of mastiffs and bloodhounds. They managed to throw him out of the bed next to the window and hold him at bay there. Mother Thénardier had not let go of his hair. "You," Thénardier said to her, "stay out of it. You'll rip your shawl." Mother Thénardier obeyed, as the she-wolf obeys the wolf, with a growl. "The rest of you," said Thénardier, "search him." Monsieur Leblanc seemed to have abandoned the idea of resistance. They searched him. He had nothing on him except a leather purse that contained 6 francs and his handkerchief. Thénardier shoved the hanky in his pocket.
"Jesus, no wallet?"
he asked.
"No watch, either,"
answered one of the chimney specialists.
"Just what you'd expect," murmured the masked man who held the big key in the voice of a ventriloquist. "This one's an old bruiser from way back."
Thénardier went over to the corner by the door, grabbed a bundle of ropes from the floor and threw it to them.
"Tie him to the foot of the bed," he said.
Then, seeing the old man was still sprawled across the floor from the punch Monsieur Leblanc had given him and was not moving, he said,
"Boulatruelle's not dead, is he?"
"No," answered Bigrenaille. "He's drunk."
"Sweep him into a corner," said Thénardier. Two of the chimney specialists pushed the drunk with their feet over to the heap of old scrap iron.
"Babe, what did you bring so many men for?"
Thénardier said in a low voice to the man with the cudgel. "There's no point."
"What's a man to do?"
replied the man with the cudgel.
"They all wanted to be in on it. The season's slow, business is bad."
The pallet Monsieur Leblanc had been thrown onto was a kind of hospital bed supported by 4 big, rough, uneven posts. Monsieur Leblanc did not struggle. The brigands tied him up good and tight, standing upright with his feet on the floor to the bedpost farthest from the window and closest to the fireplace. When the last knot had been tied, Thénardier pulled up a chair and sat almost facing Monsieur Leblanc. Thénardier was a different man now. Within a few seconds, his expression had shifted from unbridled violence to a calm and relaxed cunning. Marius hardly recognized in this polite office clerk's smile the almost bestial maw foaming away in a frenzy only a moment before. He studied this fantastic and alarming metamorphosis in amazement, feeling what any man would feel on seeing a tiger change into an attorney.
"Monsieur,"
Thénardier began. Waving away the brigands who still had their hands on Monsieur Leblanc, he said,
"Back off a bit, and let me have a chat with the gentleman."
They all stepped back toward the door.
"Monsieur, you were wrong to try and jump out the window. You could have broken a leg. Now, if you don't mind, we're going to have a quiet little chat. To start with, I must tell you something I've noticed, and that is that you haven't yet let out the slightest protest."
Thénardier was right. This detail was accurate, though it had escaped Marius in his distress. Monsieur Leblanc had hardly uttered more than a few words, and that without raising his voice. Even in his struggle with the 6 brigands by the window, he had kept profoundly and strangely silent. Thénardier went on.
"My God, if you'd cried thief for a bit, I wouldn't have found it out of place. Murder, the word is used on occasion, and for my part I wouldn't have taken it amiss. It's only natural that a man make a bit of a racket when he finds himself with individuals who don't exactly inspire sufficient confidence. If you'd done that, we wouldn't have touched you. We wouldn't even have muzzled you, and I'll tell you why. It's because this room here is soundproof. That's all it's got going for it, but at least it has that. It's like a cellar. You could let a bomb